Thanks for having me here. So I'll talk about some binary black hole simulations and models that are dependent on these simulations, but are much faster. Okay. So I'm sure most people have seen this movie before, but I'll just show it again. So this is a visualization of a binary black hole system. And so what you see is two black holes that are orbiting each other, and they're getting closer because they lose energy to gravitational waves, and then eventually they get close enough that they can merge into a single black hole, and then we see the gravitational waves distorting the space-time around it. And the main reason we want to do these kind of simulations, and here you can't, maybe you can't see it that well, but the gravitational waves are the contours here. The main reason we want to do these kind of simulations is to make predictions for the expected gravitational waves. And that is because these waves, when once they're emitted from the system, they travel across billions of light years and until they reach Earth, which should happen right now. There you go. And then, so these waves, when they reach Earth, they distort the space-time around us. And this is, of course, vastly exaggerated. This is vastly exaggerated, and the real scale is a fraction of the size of a hydrogen nucleus. So, but because they're so small, we need the most precise instruments ever built, and that's LIGO and Virgo. So here's one of the LIGO instruments. And so now that we have these super precise instruments, there's still, to understand the data that these instruments collect, we need predictions of the expected gravitational waves that can tell us how a different source will generate a wave in different ways. And so to do that, we need to solve Einstein's equations. And in particular, I'll focus on binary black holes. So just to make sure that everybody understands the dimensions of this problem, so each black hole has a mass and a spin. So that's the mass, and the arrow indicates the spin. So the spin is a three-dimensional vector, and I'm using dimensionless spins, which go in magnitude between 0 and 1. When you want to predict the gravitational waves using a model, you don't need to worry about the total mass because it scales out. So in effect, we only have the ratio of the two masses, which I'll call Q. So in total, we have 7 parameters that we need to worry about: the mass ratio and 1 spin vector per black hole. So given this system, it actually has several stages in the evolution. When the black holes are far away, they're in spiraling around each other, and they get closer and closer, and that's the initial part. And then they get close enough eventually that they merge, and the merger is usually associated with the peak of the waveform. And after the merger, you have a highly distorted single black hole, but all these distortions are quickly radiated away, and that's the ring down part of the signal. And in the initial part, you can use approximate analytical methods like post-Newtonian theory to predict the gravitational waveform. And similarly, at late times, after there's only a single black hole, you can use black hole perturbation theory. But in the region in between, the space-time is highly dynamical, and the black holes are moving at about half the speed of light. So you need to solve the Einstein's equations numerically, and that's where numerical relativity comes in. So as you might imagine, this is a pretty complicated problem. It took us a few decades to figure out how to solve the binary black hole problem. And even until about 2004, it was considered very difficult to even evolve a single black hole, a single orbit close to the merger. So this was a paper that for the first time could evolve one orbit very close to the merger. So, but pretty soon after this, there was a big breakthrough, and we could evolve binary black holes. And so this is the paper by Franz Pretorius, which showed the first evolution through the merger of binary black holes. And this was followed quickly by two other groups that reproduced this. So this was an important milestone in binary black holes, and we could now essentially solve the two-body problem in full GR. And we've come a long way since then. Nowadays, binary black hole simulations are more or less routine. In fact, our collaboration, the SXX collaboration, published about 2,000 simulations recently in a public catalog. And this is a parameter space plot of the simulations just to show that we have good coverage. But I won't go into too much details. But for the experts, I'll explain what precessing simulations means, but we have good coverage in precessing and non-precessing simulations. In mass ratio, we have good coverage in non-precessing up to about 4, and for precessing up to about 8. But I'll go into more details on that later. So nowadays, we can do these we can do a few thousand of them in a year. However, to get some more idea about how to think about numerical relativity, I like to think of it in a schematic picture. So we have a system that we want to solve the Einstein's equations for, a binary black hole system. And to do that, you solve the Einstein's equations. And because the equations become intractable close to merger, we essentially give the problem to a supercomputer. And this solves equations and spits out the outputs that we care about, the gravitational waveform, which escapes to infinity. But there's also another important output, which is the properties of the final black hole, in particular, the mass and the spin. The gravitational waveform is used to compare with the data and infer the properties of the signal, properties of the source, while the final black hole properties are used to test general relativity. So in the ring down signal, there are certain characteristic frequencies called the quasi-normal mode frequencies, which entirely depend upon the mass and the spin of the final black hole. So if you have an accurate prediction of the final black hole, black hole's properties, you can then look for these frequencies in the ring down, and by doing that, you can test general relativity. So numerical relativity is good at predicting these two very, very important outputs for gravitational wave data analysis. But the main problem here is that it relies on a supercomputer. So each simulation takes about a month. So if you want to do this inference problem, it takes about 1 million to 10 million evaluations of the waveform. So it would take you 1 million years to do the analysis. So because of this, several approximate methods to predict the gravitational waveform have been developed. And the main approaches are IMR phenom and EOB, or effective one-body approaches. And the general idea for these models is you start with an analytical prediction and add corrections to it. So this, for example, is the post-Newtonian prediction for the gravitational wave phase. You can ignore these constant terms. So this is essentially an expansion in the frequency up to 7th power. So that's what post-Newtonian theory tells us. And then this model takes that prediction and adds higher order corrections at higher orders in frequency. And so all these sigmas here are free parameters. So by doing this, this extends the validity of the model to higher frequencies, which means later in spiral. And these sigmas are then figured out by comparing with numerical relativity simulations. So, but you can ask the question, is this the real underlying physics? And are we introducing any bias by picking the phenomenology ourselves? And what's the limit of this approach? And also, is there a way we can directly use numerical relativity simulations without having to introduce some physics ourselves? So that's the idea of surrogate modeling. We follow a purely data-driven approach where we directly interpolate between numerical relativity simulations. So again, going back to the schematic picture, so we have a binary black hole system. And in the model that I'm going to talk about, we use 1,500 supercomputer simulations, each of which took about a month. And then for these simulations, we get the two outputs that we really care about. And we give all of this data to the model. Essentially, then the model essentially learns from the data how different properties of the source give you different outputs from the simulations. So this is in spirit similar to a machine learning problem, but we use slightly different techniques. But the model still figures out from the data without us having to introduce assumptions. So at the end of this training process, what we have is a surrogate model, which can now reproduce those outputs.
Are you not introducing the implicit assumption that the simulations you have are covering the space and then you're going to be trying to fill in the space in between?
Right, so we can test how well it performs when, for example, we can do new simulations and test on those. or we can leave out some of our data and test on that. So how well is it actually interpolating when you don't already tell the model what to do at that data point? And so that's something I'll talk about. Okay, so going back to the schematic picture, so in this, the part that the surrogate model reproduces is solving the Einstein's equations. We don't do that directly anymore. Instead, we take the outputs and build a model based on that. But as I'll show later, the model evaluation is very cheap, so you don't need a supercomputer anymore. You can do it on any dusty old desktop computer or a laptop. And at the end of the day, you get the same kind of predictions for the gravitational waveform and the final black hole properties. And also, as I'll show later, this can be done without losing any accuracy or at an accuracy comparable to the simulations. So surrogate models, in that sense, take the accuracy of full numerical relativity simulations and bring them to direct data analysis, or you know, you can evaluate them on your computers. So to get a better idea of how this works, I'll take a simple example of a one-dimensional surrogate model. So assuming there's no spins, the only parameter we have is the mass ratio. So let's say this is the parameter space of interest. So even though this is one-dimensional, I'm showing it as a patch so that it extends to higher dimensions. So in that patch, let's say we have a bunch of simulations. And all these markers here are the different simulations that we already have. But because the simulations are so expensive, we only have sparse distribution in the region of interest. Now what we want to do is essentially interpolate between all of them so we can cover the full patch or the full parameter space. And to do that, we start by building a suitable basis for our waveforms. And this basis is built using the waveforms from the simulations themselves. So we want to represent our waveform as a sum of bases with some basis coefficients. So these E, I of T are the different bases. So to do this, we start with, let's say, just two randomly picked basis functions. And then we can orthonormalize them. And this will be, let's say, these are the two beginning basis functions. And now, given that basis, we can project all the waveforms in our data set, all of these markers, onto that basis. And we can compute the projection errors involved in that projection. And then we pick the data point that has the highest projection error and add that to our next iteration of our basis. So you can think of that as picking the point that is most orthogonal to the existing basis. Or in other words, it's the most important data point that we need to add to our basis. And we do this iteratively until the projection errors go below a certain threshold, which is set by the numerical relativity resolution. So you can also think of it in a slightly different way. So this is the mass ratio, which is the parameter space that we care about in this example. And this is the time. And so let's say the basis functions that we picked give us the waveforms that I'm showing now. So let's say there's four of those waveforms that are required to, required to populate a parameter space. Because the waveforms are so highly oscillatory, it's usually nicer to work with slowly varying functions of time. So we can use the amplitude and the phase of the waveforms. And in this example, I'll show a surrogate for the amplitude. So these four waveforms or amplitudes are the ones that we picked out to build our basis. And in doing that, we essentially reduce this whole parameter space into those four set of waveforms. And now we want to do something similar in the time direction. And we do that again by picking the most representative time values that can help us build an interpolant in time. But it turns out that, maybe I should say this first. So when we want to evaluate the amplitude at some mass ratio, we already picked out our basis functions. And along with that, we need the coefficients that we sum with the basis function. But we only can compute these coefficients at regions where we already have simulations. So what we essentially want to do is interpolate these coefficients across parameter space so that we have a prediction for the coefficient at any mass ratio. But something convenient that we take advantage of is that you can actually invert the relation between the amplitude at all these times that we picked out, so amplitude as a function of mass ratio and different times. you can translate that to the basis coefficients at that mass ratio. So I won't go into details of that. It just involves a matrix inversion. So now, essentially, we've picked out all of our basis functions and our most important times. So we essentially have a matrix of data. And now we want to predict the fits at any region. So we do a, we want to predict the coefficients at any mass ratio. So we do a fit across parameter space at each of these points.
What are those important times?
So these are the ones that will give us the most accurate interpolation in time. So we again do that iteratively by picking the one that reduces the error the most. Okay, so now let's say we want to evaluate our amplitude at this point. And this is a point where we don't already have a numerical relativity simulation. So, but we have these fits, so we can compute the amplitude at that mass ratio at all of the different times. And that, again, by a matrix inversion, gives us the coefficients at that mass ratio. We already have the basis functions, and now we have the basis coefficients. We can just sum all of them up to get the amplitude at this point where we didn't previously have data. So in that sense, we essentially use the existing numerical relativity simulations to interpolate between them. So here I skipped a lot of the caveats, but this is the essential underlying process of building the survey.
So these basis functions, you put them how?
Sorry, can you say?
Basis functions, the use of eyes. So where do you get them from?
They are taken from the waveforms itself. So they are given some set of waveforms. We orthonormalize them, and those are our basis functions.
How do you take E0 of T from work? So I take the waveform. Because I could imagine, so this is related to the previous question. So depending on different values and different functions that you might choose, then the points at which you say these are the ideal points might differ.
Right. So we choose the first one we choose randomly, but all the other ones we choose such that we get the highest projection errors given the current basis set. So then it turns out that it doesn't depend very strongly on your seed value of the basis function. You still get a good basis no matter where you start in your parameters.
I think it's just a few days ago, there was a paper by Team Liu on the Steele that basically says you can actually infer what the ideal basis functions would be.
So I think that was not just the basis function. I mean,
well, yeah, the whole shape. What would be the ideal interpolation or functional form that you should use?
Right, so that's different. So there you have some set of functions to choose from, and then you let the data tell you how to combine them and so on. But here, so that requires essentially a surrogate model as the underlying model.
Right.
But this is essentially given only simulations. How do we first build a surrogate model? And here we don't make assumptions about some functions of the parameter space. And so far also it looks like they haven't, their method works only in some subspace of the full parameter space. But yeah, but it's still interesting.
So how do you determine CIQ?
We can compute CIQ at all the values where we have the simulations. It's just a projection. So you can use the orthonormality of the basis to compute CI at all the values where you have all the points where you have simulations, and then you can essentially build a fit for the CI across Q, and then you can evaluate it at any point.
What kind of fits do you use? Just like polynomial interpolation?
So in this example, I used quadratic fits, but in general we have a higher dimensional problem. The one I'm talking about has seven dimensions, which I couldn't picture it here. But so there we use some combinations of the different parameters. So with different, so we our basis functions there for the fits are monomials of the different parameters. So like Q power cubed or Q squared and so on. And then we use products of those basis functions. And so we can generate a lot of basis functions like that, but we again pick the ones that will give us the best fit. And so we can test by taking our full data set and leaving some of the samples out, and then building a fit on the data, but testing on the samples we left out. and that tells us which are the important basis functions to include for the fits. Yeah, but that's for the general seven-dimensional case. Okay. Okay. So in the model that I'll talk about today is for precessing binary black holes. And to get an idea of what those are, these are some movies that I made. So in these movies, the black holes are represented by the markers. The size of the black hole tells you the mass. And the spins are represented by the arrows here. And then the orbital plane is shown by those tracks. And the orbital angular momentum is that pink arrow in the middle. And it's always perpendicular to the plane of the orbit. So it tells you the orientation of the orbit. This is the plus polarization of the gravitational wave as seen by an observer that's facing here, so anyone in the room. And then this is the plus polarization as seen by an observer living in that patch over there. So whenever the whenever the color is red, it means that the space-time is being stretched. And whenever it's blue, it means that it's being compressed. So the main difference between the two cases here is that in the left case, the spins of the black hole are either along the orbital angular momentum or opposite to it. So they are called aligned spin binary black holes. While here, they can have generic orientations with respect to the orbital angular momentum. And these are called precessing systems because as the binary evolves, the spins here will interact with the orbit and cause the orbital plane to precess. And so here, the orbital plane is always in the XY plane, while here, you can see that the plane changes as the binary evolves. And this has an important imprint on the gravitational waveform, where we see all of these modulations because of this precession. Yes?
What you put in is the effective spin. Weighted spin vector dotted into the angular momentum vector. So you can choose either the spin to be large or small, or misalignment. What do you choose? Degeneracy.
I mean, the effective spin is still, so it tells you how, even for the aligned spin case, you can compute the effective spin and it tells you kind of how fast the binary will merge, whether it'll merge at lower or higher frequencies. But for precessing systems, the thing that matters is the in-plane spin, which is perpendicular to the orbital angular momentum. So the effective spin is a projection along the orbital angular momentum. So this is the some people use this chi p kind of in-plane spin parameterization for that.
The data for the events. Clusters around chi equal to zero.
Yes.
So either because the spin is very small or because they're misaligned.
Right.
So how do you test this?
So we need high signal to noise ratio so that you can distinguish between small differences. So at current sensitivities, we are very sensitive to chi effective and not the other combination of spins, like the chi1 minus chi2, we are not very sensitive to that. But as LIGO improves, we'll become sensitive to that, so you can then distinguish between the
two. It's very difficult for the simulations to test the spin parameter.
So from the simulations, we get the spins by measuring them on the apparent horizons in the simulations. So this doesn't have anything to do with LIGO or what LIGO can do.
Yes.
Okay, so this, because the precession directly has an effect on the waveform, we can use that to infer the spins of the black hole, which can then tell us about how the black holes were formed and so on. So modeling precession is a very important topic. Okay, so also to further motivate precession, this is a precessing top. So here the axis of the rotation is tilted with respect to the vertical, and as the top evolves, the axis precesses about the vertical direction, and analogously here the orbital angular momentum as well as the spins they precess about the total orbital angular momentum direction. But this is only an approximate analogy because here gravity is driving the precession, which is an external force for this object. But here it's all, there's no external force. But this is where the name comes from. Okay, so the particular model I'll talk about is called NR70Q4. 70 is for the seven dimensions, and Q4 is for the mass ratios that we include in our model. So we go up to mass ratios 4. And this is the parameter space of the seven dimensions. You don't need to look at that very carefully. I just wanted to show that we have good coverage of the seven dimensions that we care about. We use 1,528 numerical relativity simulations. But if you think about it, we have seven dimensions. So if you look at the number of simulations per dimension, it's only about 2.85 simulations. So it's still a very sparse distribution of points. We also include several higher order modes. So if you think about the modes, if you want to model the gravitational waveform on a sphere around the source, a convenient way to do that is to split them into a sum of spin-weighted spherical harmonics. So these are the spherical harmonics, and then all you need to model now is these time series of functions, which we call the different modes. And typically in this summation, the L equal to 2, M equal to 2 mode, which is the quadrupole mode, is the dominant one. And for that reason, most waveform models until very recently typically used to model only that, but the higher order modes become important as you go towards higher mass ratios, so we include all the ones up to L equal to 4. And apart from the waveform, we also model the spin and the precessing frame dynamics, so we model how the spins change as a function of time and how the orbital plane changes as a function. And all of these are internally used by the surrogate, so that's the main reason we model them, but they're also data outputs on their own. Okay, so like I was saying, this is the precessing effect of the binary black hole system modulates the waveforms, but this looks pretty complicated. So we want to try and simplify this when trying to build a model. So we do that by going into a special frame called the co-precessing frame. And this frame essentially tracks the precession of the orbit so that the z direction is always along the orbital angular momentum direction. So that's shown here. So this is the orbital angular momentum direction. And in this frame, if you see, the waveform looks much nicer. It's always monotonically increasing in amplitudes. It almost looks like an aligned spin waveform. So this makes it much nicer to model, so we take advantage of this. In fact, we do a few more tricks. So this is the gravitational waveform in the inertial frame. So the orange is the 2-2 mode, and the blue is the 2-1 mode. However, notice that now the 2-1 mode is comparable in amplitude. Sorry.
When you go to the co-processing frame,
yes.
Why still makes a difference between, I mean, no precession at all? Because it's almost the same.
What's the difference between this and no precession at all?
Once you write the co-processing frame.
So there's actually, maybe I can explain it in the next one better. So there's there are some effects of precession that you cannot take away by a frame translation. So these are like mutations and so on, but I'll talk about that here. So the 2-1 mode here, as you can see, is comparable in amplitude to the 2-2 mode, which is against what we normally expect for aligned spin systems, where 2-2 is always the dominant one. But in the co-precessing frame, there's a nicer hierarchy of modes which we expect, and this is because in the inertial frame, this rotation causes mixing of modes between all the modes of a fixed L but different M, because that's how the rotation works for the spherical harmonic modes. So then in this co-processing frame, it's nicer in terms of the hierarchy, as well as most of the modulations are removed. But we can do something further. In the co-processing frame, we can do a rotation about the z-axis by the amount equal to the instantaneous orbital phase. So by doing that, we are essentially tracking the rotation of the black holes as well as the rotation of the frame. So in this frame, the black holes are always on the x-axis, then they just get closer and closer. So this takes out most of the oscillatory features, and it looks almost like an amplitude, but with these small modulations. These are the nutations, which if you look at the same thing for an aligned spin system, it would look non-monotonic, but these cannot be removed just by a frame translation. Sorry. But we can do something even further to account to simplify that. So if you look at the 2-2 and the 2-2 modes for the same system, they'll have modulations with opposite signs. And then you can take advantage of this and use plus and minus combinations of these two. So this is the plus combination where now all the modulations are removed. And this now looks like an aligned spin amplitude. And all the modulations are pushed down into this subdominant piece, which is the minus piece. But by doing this, we model the dominant part of the waveform much more accurately, which increases the accuracy of the overall model. We also model this, but we are not as accurate in modeling. So by doing this, these tricks of frame transformation and rotations, we go from this complicated picture to this much nicer, easier to model picture. And now we build an independent surrogate model for each of these different data pieces. And at the end of the day, what we want now is the waveform in the inertial frame. So we also model the frame transformations that take us from the inertial frame to the co-processing frame, which is the rotation of the orbit. And then the co-orbital frame, co-processing to the co-orbital frame, which is essentially modeling the orbital phase as a function of time. So given all of that, we can go from this and go back to the inertial frame when evaluating the model. But the model itself is constructed in this simpler picture. Okay. So without going into more details of the methods, I'll skip to the results. So given the surrogate model, we now want to test how well it performs. And one way to do that is using this quantity called the mismatch, which is essentially an inner product between any two waveforms. And you can think of the mismatch as the lower the mismatch, the closer two waveforms are to each other. Okay, so this red histogram is the mismatch error for the surrogate model when compared against the numerical relativity simulations. So like you were asking, we don't want to test on the data that we already trained the model on. So instead, what we do is we break up our data set into sets of 20. And then for each set, we use the rest of the data to build the model and test on that data that we did not use to train the model. So all of these errors are out-of-sample errors or cross-validation errors. So they represent a conservative estimate of the model. So that's these errors. And then the black histogram is the estimated numerical relativity resolution error, which we compute by comparing the two highest resolutions of our simulations. So as you can see, the surrogate errors are at the same level as the numerical relativity errors. So this suggests that we are doing nearly as well as we possibly can. We are at the limit of the numerical relativity errors, and also that using this kind of a surrogate model is similar to using a full numerical relativity.
My question was more, have you tested with something where the parameters are outside?
Yes.
For example, so in your case, video do a Q equal 8 mass ratio.
Right, so we tested that. So this is up to Q4, but we tested them at Q6. And they work, extrapolation is worse than interpolation, but it is still much better than any of the other models. And I have a plot somewhere. Yes, Daniel?
So how do you do the cross-validation here? So how do you exactly get the distribution? Just by leaving like one simulation out at a time?
No, so we leave 5% of the data out at a time. So like 75 out of the 1500 we leave out at a time. And we repeat this a lot of times to get these statistics. Okay, so these are the errors for the surrogate model, and you can compare them with an existing model such as SEOB and RV3, which is from the EOB family, and typically the errors are about an order of magnitude larger. And the main reason here is that this model does not calibrate to precessing simulations. It is calibrated only against aligned spin simulations, and then some frame rotations are applied based on the EOB dynamics to go from an aligned spin system to a precessing system. But this only captures the precessing effects approximately, which is the main improvement.
So just a question about the resolution. There's a tail for the numeric relativity that goes to pretty high mismatch.
Right.
So maybe that suggests you shouldn't even be using those simulations, right?
So actually, we understand that as it's coming from junk radiation, essentially. So even though we truncate the junk radiation before doing these errors, we find that the junk radiation can impact the spins a little bit, but we don't fully resolve it, so it impacts the spins of different resolutions in different ways. So for example, the in-plane spins can change by a small, a few degrees or so. And this essentially leads to this because they are different physical systems now that you shouldn't really be comparing. And if we, now we've actually fixed this in the next set of simulations where we stop our simulation after junk radiation and then branch into multiple resolutions so that our post-junk initial data is exactly the same for all of them. And that essentially removes all of this tail and it goes to 10 per minus 2 level.
But for this comparison, I'll just fit to the highest resolution
right.
And that is the right answer.
Right. So the surrogate is not affected by this, but the NR estimate of the error is affected. So we're not worried about this for the model, but only particularly this plot, essentially. So to get a more concrete idea of how these models perform, this is the worst case in the previous plot for the surrogate model. The black histogram is the NR data. The dashed red is the surrogate model. So even in its worst case, it tracks the NR data reasonably well. There is some slight offset. But if you compare it with the EOB model, there's a much bigger difference. And now this is the worst case for the EOB model, which has a pretty large difference. And in this case, the surrogate happens to do very well. So all of this is essentially represented in the previous plot, but this is just to give a more concrete idea. OK, so given all of this, you can ask the question, are we ready for high precision gravitational wave astronomy? Like as we keep improving our detectors, are we ready to predict the right waveforms for those detectors? So you can take an estimate of the mismatch, and then you can translate that into a signal-to-noise ratio at which that difference will become significant. So this is only approximate an order of magnitude, but we can use it to estimate this. And this is from this paper. So essentially, given a mismatch, you can compute a signal-to-noise ratio at which your systematic errors due to modeling errors will start to dominate the statistical errors due to the detector noise. So for the EOB model I showed, this is the level of the SNRs. And then for the surrogate model, they're about an order of magnitude larger. And then you can compare these signal-to-noise ratios with the signal-to-noise ratio for the first gravitational wave event. So that was in 2015 with SNR about 25. And then at design sensitivity, it'll be three. The LIGO detector will be 3 times as sensitive, roughly. So SNR will be about 3 times. And at 3G, which is the next generation of gravitational wave detectors, we expect 10 times more sensitivity than the design sensitivity. So that'll be here. So then you can say that by about 2022 for this current existing EOB model, the systematic errors will start to completely dominate. While for the same level of, if you impose the same requirement, for the surrogate, it should be fine until about 2035, which is about 15 years for now. So we can worry about that later.
I'm confused about the plot. So what I'm seeing here, so here is the horizontal is a signal to noise ratio. Is the distinguishability of what?
The distinguishability between NR and the model. So if you assume NR is a true solution, then your model errors will become, your modeling approximations will start to become distinguishable at that level of SNR.
So why do
I
have a...
This is essentially taking these mismatch distributions and putting it into this formula.
So one question is, I'm sure you guys don't care about this, but has anyone thought of the formula, as you mentioned at the beginning of your talk, there was a Venom approach and there was a EOB, and then you come in parallel set up, we want to do a different interpolation in between, and we're going to use a surrogate model to fit that. Mm-hmm. But they could have equally gone to the Venom of the EOB, look at what they were doing there, and add to that expansion some other terms, or try to find what would be orthogonal basis functions to improve upon those. Has anyone looked into this? When you give me a surrogate model, it's a surrogate model, there when I can point to different terms in that expression, so this comes from this physical effect. Well, in your case, it's aggregate.
Right.
when I gain a lot of accuracy, I lose a little bit in
physics.
We actually gain intuition on those
right.
coefficients.
So I don't think anybody has looked into building a combined model. But one limitation there would be maybe you're already introducing assumptions with the current phenom models that you may have to remove first before introducing the right corrections with different phenomena.
You need as well. You pick your first function. That's a strong assumption.
But we pick only from the numerical relativity waveform.
Sure.
So
it's a function. I can imagine that function that EOB is doing is with the parameters. That's function number one. And now I look at the orthogonal functions of those, and then I don't know if it's going to do better, but I mean, it's something that they could do if they go in this direction.
Right.
Especially when that's comparisons of EOB versus NR, well, there's a lot more muscle that we can put in this approach.
Right.
Who knows what is the right way of knowing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the first thing that they're trying to do here is calibrate against precessing simulations, not necessarily in the surrogate approach, but including their Hamiltonian some effects for precession, which they don't include, which I think was the order one thing to do. And based on what they find based on that model, I think they can use some combined methods. And for one of our models, we actually do something similar. So we had this model is based only on NR simulation, so it only has about 20 orbits. But that means that you can't use it for total masses less than 60. But we used a hybridized model where we include PN in the early in spiral and then switch to NR later on. But we did that so far only for the aligned spin cases. And for that, one of the tricks we did was to make the modeling easier, we first subtracted the PN prediction from the waveform. And then all you need to care about is the late in spiral and more. So it's kind of in the similar. Okay, so, but you can say at 2035, even the surrogate methods will fail, but because the model right now reproduces NR at a comparable accuracy and is limited by NR, all you really need to do is more accurate NR simulations, which will become possible in the future, and so you can update your surrogate with those simulations.
What about these longer waveforms where you need PN calculations?
To go down to 10 per minus 8. So NR is not there right now, but if you take a PN model as your underlying model and build a surrogate for that, you can reproduce that. And I was able to do that until 10 per minus 10 level mismatch.
So most of the SNR comes from the low frequency value, right? So the frequency is low. Well, you need to use PN calculation to build up the model.
Right.
I'm saying maybe your PN systematics is larger than 10 by 7, right? So, right? So unless you need higher PN current, but you don't have those.
Right, so we can do longer NR simulations so that we reach the level where we trust PN. And so right now we only have 20 orbits. In fact, for the next model, we plan to do 40 orbits for all of our simulations. And so we can do about 1,000 of those in a year. So we think with about 40 orbits, each simulation is about 10,000 M long. And we think we can reasonably trust PN there, but we haven't fully tested it, especially for precessing systems. We need newer, more accurate simulations if you want to improve your surrogate. Okay, so far I've only talked about the waveform, but I initially said that there's this other very important output. So the next part of my talk will be about modeling the final black hole properties. And let me see how much. Okay, I only have 10 minutes, so I'll make it quick. So you can think of this picture as a nice Feynman-like diagram. So you can start with the initial system, which is your two black holes with the mass and spin, and then they get closer and they interact with each other. And all of this is modeled by NR, but I'll just hide it behind that fuzzy interaction region. And at the end of the simulation, you have the gravitational waves that escape to infinity and the final black hole which is left behind. And this has a mass and a spin. But also during the in-spiral and also close to the merger, there can be anisotropic radiation, which means that the radiation is preferentially directed. And then this will give a recoil to the center of mass of the binary. And in the end, most of this effect happens very close to the merger, and the final black hole gets a kick velocity imported to it. So that's what is shown here, and we can also model that. So all of these quantities have very nice physical interpretations, and they're intimately related to fundamental laws of conservation. So the conservation of energy is related to the final mass. For example, given the energy here, if you take out what's lost to the gravitational waves, you get the final mass. Similarly, the final spin is related to the conservation of angular momentum, and the final velocity or the kick is related to the conservation of linear momentum. So these are all quantities that we get from our simulations and are well-defined, so we can model them using surrogate modeling methods. And the main reason we want to do that is we want a map that goes from the properties of the two black holes, or the in-spiral parameters, to the parameters of the final black hole. And essentially, by doing that, we skip the strong field regime. And we want to do that because in the ring down, there are these characteristic frequencies, like I mentioned, which depend only on the final black hole's mass and spin. So you can use this feature to test general relativity. This is an example of such a test, but maybe I'll skip it. So essentially, this uses such a map to get independent predictions of the final mass and spin and test general relativity. But that's the main motivation. And so because of this, this problem of modeling the final black holes has been recognized as an important problem ever since the first numerical relativity simulations. And so this is a very recent model which predicts the final mass for aligned spin binary black hole systems. And then all of these different deltas and m's and s, all of those are different combinations of the masses and spins. And for aligned spin system, there's only three parameters, the mass ratio and the two spins along the orbital angular momentum. So this is a three-dimensional problem, but even in that case, you can see that it looks pretty messy, and all of these k's here are free parameters that are fit to numerical relativity data. So as you can imagine, extending this to seven dimensions will become quickly intractable. So we want a different method that where we don't have to pick the underlying phenomenology, and instead let the data tell us what it should be. So we use a method called Gaussian process regression, which is used in some machine learning applications. And the nice feature about this is you don't need to assume what the underlying phenomenology is, and instead you let the data speak for itself. And to think of Gaussian process regression, you can think of it as fitting a multi-dimensional Gaussian to your data, where in each region of the parameter space, the width of your Gaussian in each dimension is related to the correlation length of your data in that dimension. So by it essentially uses the data to figure out how it is varying and then fits to that. And similar to the other model, we train directly with precising simulations. And as I'll show, we achieve similar accuracy to full numerical relativity. OK, so I'll show right now. So this is the final mass prediction using our method, the Gaussian process regression approach. So again, the red histogram is the error for the surrogate model, which are, again, cross-validation or out-of-sample errors. And then the black is the NR resolution error. So again, we are very close to the NR error, while these are the errors for various existing models. And they're, again, about an order of magnitude larger. So these models also do not calibrate to precising simulation. So that's the main difference here. And they'll need to include the effects of precision to fully capture the physics. I have similar plots for the final spin, but I'll skip them in interest of time, and the final kick velocity as well. And in general, we achieve accuracy comparable to the numerical simulations.
Can you go back, sorry, to the previous one?
OK, so this is the spin magnitude.
So let's go to
this one? This one?
The one with the mass, the spin.
Ah.
So that's NR.
Right, so NR is comparing the two highest NR resolutions.
Oh, okay. So that's
And so that's yeah, that's how we estimate that error, and the surrogate error is very close to that.
And then you compare the surrogates with the higher numerical relativity simulation.
Right, and even in that we do the cross validation. So again, you can ask, do we really need this improved accuracy for these models? When will this become important? So you can again take the first gravitational wave event, GW150914. And so this is the current posterior width in the measurement of these parameters. So for the final mass, it's 0.1 and 0.1m. And for the final spin, it's 0.1 in dimensionless units. So both of these numbers are currently limited by the statistical errors. But as the detectors improve, we expect that this will go down. So at design sensitivity, which will be roughly 3 times as sensitive as O1, we can expect that roughly this will scale as inversely proportional to SNR. So these numbers will go down to about 3.3 times 10 per minus 2. And so you can take my previous plot and take the errors for the current fit, and you can look at the 95 percentile numbers. And you can see that the errors for the final mass are still well within the expected statistical error. But for the final spin, they're uncomfortably close to the statistical error. And at about 5 times the SNR, they'll become equal, and then the model will no longer be usable. So this is, of course, something we should be careful about. We want to make potentially revolutionary claims about tests of general relativity with these models. So we want our model errors to be well within the noise limits from statistical errors. So if you use the models that I talked about, they're about an order of magnitude better, which means that they should be valid until 50 times the SNR, which again will be reached in about 15 years from now with the next generation of gravitational wave detectors.
Thank you.
Yes.
What do you actually get for the remnant? Because you don't actually measure. What does the data tell you?
So what you measure is the masses and spins of the two black holes.
Yeah.
And then you can put it into a fit like this to get the measurement or the inference.
Okay. Don't you just get out when you put it in, so to
speak? Given different measurements, so different, all the different detections have different ranges for the masses and spins. So that will result in different final masses. And there's a different way to do it, where you can take only the ring down signal and then use quasi-normal modes as your model, and then the free parameters can be the mass and spin, which are not dependent on the inspiral parameters.
So another thing you could have done was like take the waveform model that you talked about in the first part and just integrate the amount of energy in angular momentum gravitational waves. So I presume that does worse than this model?
Yes, it does slightly worse, but actually better than the other existing fields, because it has precession effects. And also, especially for the kick, you can, the way we measure the kicks from the simulations is not from the coordinates measured for the final black hole, because that's gauge dependent. We use the waveform itself to estimate the kick.
But for the mass and spin, I guess it's
from the horizon quantities. I'm not sure if I fully answered your question.
You seem to put in GR, right? So you get out GR.
How is this a test of GR? You mean?
Yeah.
Right. So it is a consistency test of it's not. So for a real test of GR, you would need an alternate theory and a prediction from that theory. But we don't have that yet. So
it's a prediction. So it uses these surrogate model to predict. If you measure in 1M2, the final M and the final spin should be this. When you go to LIGO, as he was saying, you measure the quasi-normal decay rate, and you extract M prime and A prime, and then you say, are they equal to the ones you predicted? That's a standard calculation. So that's, in this sense, is what he's going after here. You could have two compact objects that are almost black holes, but they're not quite. They don't give an M counterpart, you have no idea, and then you're trying to dissect the different stages of the binary and see if it makes sense with respect to GR system or the compact objects of GR.
So I guess the question would be, if GR wasn't the correct theory, suppose it was alternative gravity theory was correct, and you went through the same sort of analysis and put that alternative theory, you you would again do similar things and say, well, here's my best fit to the data.
The problem is you don't have the alternative theory.
No, I
so maybe since it's always almost 2 weeks, let me
first. So the question is, to what extent can this be used to test GR versus saying, assuming GR is correct, this then be the parameters of the
okay, yes, let's finish.
Okay, we can get back to it. Okay, so before I finish, I have one final movie. So something I didn't mention so far is that all of these movies are made only using surrogate models. So before now, if you wanted to make a movie like this, you would have had to get a supercomputer and do a full simulation for a month and then rendered it. But because the surrogate models are so good at reproducing these simulations, once we built the model, the first thing I naturally did was build a Python package to make movies. So you can now install this with pip and make your own movies anywhere in the seven-dimensional parameter space. And so this is a particularly interesting feature called superkicks, where very close to the merger, the spins aligned in a particularly fine-tuned configuration, which maximizes the final velocity of the remnant black hole. So that should happen in a few orbits. There you go. So very close to the merger, the two spins are in the same plane, but kind of facing opposite directions. And so this is a particularly good combination to maximize the final velocity. And if I let this movie go on, you'll see that the final black hole will get a pretty high velocity. And that should happen soon. But I'll speed up the movie so you can see it easier. There you go. So in fact, the final velocity here is about 0.01 times the speed of light, which is a pretty high velocity for the remnant black hole, because this velocity is larger than the escape velocity of even the most massive galaxy that we know about, even the elliptic galaxies. So this binary black hole would get kicked out of any galaxy that we know about. And we can use models such as this to estimate the kick velocity from our gravitational wave detections and place constraints on the rates of second generation mergers, which have caught on a lot of attention recently because LIGO seems to have seen some high mass signals which cannot be explained using normal supernova kind of channels and which might need some second generation mergers to explain them. So we can use models like this to estimate rates of second generation. Okay, so to quickly summarize, numerical relativity simulations are very accurate, but unfortunately they're very expensive. So surrogate models come to the rescue and cheaply reproduce the accuracy of the simulations. I talked about models for processing binary black holes for the waveform as well as the final black hole properties. These models are more accurate than the existing ones by about an order of magnitude. And essentially, surrogate models take binary black hole simulations from supercomputers to your laptop without a loss of accuracy. And all the movies I showed about can be seen in this website. And apparently, QR codes are captured by regular cameras nowadays without the need for an app. So you can use it if you want to go to that website. And we have some nice demonstration of the physics of binary black holes using our movie, so it's a good educational tool as well. Thank you.
Is also the waveform itself available on the website?
Right. So not on this website, but it's also publicly, you can pip install it. I can show you.
So apparently, the waveform memories for each subject is also very expensive. Have you thought about using a surrogate model for the memory?
Yeah, so one of our collaborators, including me, recently had a paper about non-spinning memory waveforms and a surrogate model for that. And we could use similar methods to go all the way up to, I think, 10,000 in mass ratio. The underlying model was a black hole perturbation theory prediction. So it seems to work there as well.
So you use those black hole perturbation methods to compute the waveform and then compute your.
Right.
just wondering, I mean, is there a distinct advantage of doing these surrogates in the time domain and not in the frequency domain?
So we would like to do them in frequency domain because all the data analysis is done in the frequency domain. But one of the difficulties for this particular model is that we have to model the frame transformations. And I didn't mention that, but there's some ODE integrations involved there. So we essentially do fits for, let's say, the frequency at different times, and we integrate that to get the phase, and similarly for other quantities. And it's much easier to do that in time domain because we can use ODE integration. We can maybe reformulate that in frequency domain, but we haven't done that.
Maybe you mentioned that and I didn't get it. Out of curiosity, how many functions do you need to have in your basis?
It's actually very small. So we need, even for the processing systems, we only need at most 10 basis functions. And the reason we think is that the waveform is morphologically more or less same in different regions of the parameter space. It always looks like a waveform. But the real reason we need all those simulations is to do the fits across parameter space. And those require a lot of simulations to get an accuracy.
So how much better is this than, for example, FANUC D?
How much faster or?
No, better, like in.
Phenom P. V3 is comparable to the EOB model I showed, roughly.
So you have 10 waveforms in the base. Did you try changing that?
Which set of basis functions we use?
Yeah. So the number, things like that.
Right. So that's essentially set by some tolerance for basis functions. We don't pick the number, but the tolerance error. And we changed it, and that's not the limiting error right now. So we choose enough basis functions that we are at the NR resolution. So including more will be modeling noise, essentially.
But on that, it would be interesting to see, say, the capital 4. I think FANUC D has 4, right?
4.
It has 4 free functions. So we just say, well, if you capital whatever limit they have, does your model to feel better? That would be an indication that they're not picking the ideal functions. I mean, somehow your model is.
Yeah, so I don't know if you can, if you want to keep the number of functions fixed, I think.
No, I agree with you. You don't want that, but yes. Just to try and assess what's maybe missing in the R approaches.
Right. I mean, so I think essentially there needs to be a better ANSATs, and one way, one limitation for the FANUC models is that you might need more simulations to figure out the right ANSATs, and so you can actually use a surrogate model to make a million waveforms and then and train on that to pick out the right underlying phenomenology from that. But I don't think anybody has done that.
Last questions? Okay. Thank you,
Jacob. Thank you.